Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Bush's latest Supreme Court nominee, Conservative Appeals Court Judge Samuel Alito, is already on Capitol Hill making courtesy calls on the senators who will decide whether or not he ultimately joins the high court. The choice of Alito follows the failed nomination of the president's counsel, Harriet Myers. She withdrew last week under withering pressure from conservative activists. President Bush introduced Alito at the White House this morning, in contrast to his introduction of Myers, whom he touted as being unencumbered by a judicial record. The president said Alito has more judicial experience than any Supreme Court nominee in 70 years.
He understands that judges are to interpret the laws, not to impose their preferences or priorities on the people. In the performance of his duties, Judge Alito has gained the respect of his colleagues and attorneys for his brilliance and decency. He's won admirers across the political spectrum. I'm confident that the United States Senate will be impressed by Judge Alito's distinguished record, his measured judicial temperament, and his tremendous personal integrity. And I urge the Senate to act promptly on this important nomination so that an up or down vote is held before the end of this year.
Samuel Alito is a native of Trenton, New Jersey. He's 55 years old. He has law degrees from Princeton and Yale. Accepting the nomination at the White House this morning, Alito thanked the president for his confidence, and Alito also touched on his own judicial philosophy.
Every time that I have entered the courtroom during the past 15 years, I have been mindful of the solemn responsibility that goes with service as a federal judge. Federal judges have the duty to interpret the Constitution and the laws faithfully and fairly, to protect the constitutional rights of all Americans, and to do these things with care and with restraint, always keeping in mind the limited role that the courts play in our constitutional system. And I pledge that if confirmed, I will do everything within my power to fulfill that responsibility.
Federal Appeals Court Judge Samuel Alito, the president's latest choice to join the U.S. Supreme Court, speaking at the White House this morning. Well, the response is coming in. Lanier Swan is director of government relations for Concerned Women for America. That's one of the largest Christian advocacy groups in the country. Now, we spoke to Lanier after Harriet Myers' withdrawal last week, and she told us then she wanted the next nominee to be a strict interpreter of the Constitution in the mold of Scalia and Thomas. Well, we asked her today if she got what she wanted in Judge Alito.
I believe that the American people are getting what they wanted, much more important than whether or not we are getting what we wanted. The president has fulfilled his promise to those that put him back in office for this very reason, and I do believe this is a supreme pick for the Supreme Court on a number of different levels.
Do you think Mr. Alito has the same values as your group, and if so, which values are they?
We have long said that for us it's not about a values litmus test. Our main point was that he share our opinion on one issue, and that is the Constitution. Obviously, we're still researching and learning about the judge and where he stands on a number of topics. But for now, he fits the only thing and the only criteria mold we were concerned about, and that is that of a strict constitutionalist.
Your group strongly pro-life. Do you want, if he is to become justice, a Justice Alito to work to overturn Roe v. Wade? And what do you think his stand is on abortion?
I can't speak for Judge Alito on where he stands on the life issue. I can only speak to where he stands on the Constitution. And, of course, there are several scholars there on both sides of the life issue, both pro-choice and pro-life, who believe that Roe was a bad decision constitutionally. And what we do know about Judge Alito is that he is a constitutional scholar on many levels. I mean, this is a man with the deep breadth of knowledge and respect for the Constitution that is so necessary on our bench right now.
Well, are you prepared for a major fight in Congress, even a possible filibuster over the nomination?
Absolutely. We were prepared for a fight long before Alito was even named this morning. We think that it is high time that the American people are allowed to hear the debate on the number of issues that really do make this so partisan. The fight over this nominee will really reveal the leftist agenda for what it is. And I think that we're really going to come away with a high respect for this nominee and for the president that's introduced him to the American people this morning.
Lanier Swan, Director of Government Relations with Concerned Women for for America, a leading conservative advocacy group. Lanier, thanks so much.
Thanks so much, Robin.
And now to Ralph Neese, president of the liberal advocacy group People for the American Way. We also spoke with Ralph last Thursday, and at the time he called Meyer's withdrawal an astounding spectacle and an example of how the right wing dominates politically. Well, we asked him today for his thoughts on the Alito nod.
Regrettably, President Bush has capitulated for the second time in 5 days. They forced him to withdraw Harriet Myers. Now they've dictated the choice of Samuel Alito, who is a right-wing judicial activist who will try to vote to turn back the constitutional clock 7 decades on a range of issues protecting privacy and civil rights, religious liberty, reproductive rights.
Well, wait a minute, Ralph Neese. Samuel Alito has always been on the president's shortlist. What are his decisions that give you such cause for concern?
He has been on the list for some time. He is certainly in the mold of Robert Bork, Clarence Thomas, and Antonin Scalia. There are a range of issues. His decision back in 1991 with respect to requiring spousal consent if a woman decides to have an abortion. Thankfully, that did not become the law of the land through the Supreme Court.
Well, as you probably know, some observers are saying he can't be that easily pigeonholed. For instance, there was a school decision in which he wrote that a school doesn't have the right to punish students for vulgar language when that language doesn't disrupt the school day. He saw it as a violation of free speech if schools could punish kids. And some observers are saying that's not at all a conservative outcome.
Robin, even with Robert Bork and Clarence Thomas and Antonin Scalia, there are certain decisions we're in agreement with the three of them. However, when you're looking at a broad judicial philosophy, Samuel Alito believes that the Constitution in large measure has been misinterpreted since the 1930s.
Do you think he's an originalist?
I'm not sure how he's going to define himself, and you'll hear originalists, you'll hear first principles, you'll hear strict construction, you'll hear judges who interpret the law and don't make the law. Those are all vague phrases that mask what's really going on. Because remember, Sandra Day O'Connor was the decisive and fifth vote on dozens of decisions that protect privacy, that protect equal opportunity, that protect clean air and clean water. He could be a walking constitutional amendment that would undo decades of constitutional precedence.
Ralph Neese, president of People for the American Way, the liberal advocacy group. Ralph, thanks.
You're welcome, Robin. Take care.
And again, we also spoke earlier with Lanier Swan of Concerned Women for America. She was delighted with the Alito nomination, so a potentially divisive candidate in Samuel Alito. We're joined now by Jonathan Turley, professor of law at George Washington University. Jonathan, Judge Alito was on the short list, so you're not surprised, but your reaction?
Well, with this nomination, the president has really marked the build has paid with his base. I mean, you can't get much more conservative than Sam Alito. And in that sense, his conservative base should be grateful. And in a strange sense, maybe the Democrats are equally grateful because he gave them a candidate that very well could coalesce all of the groups into a very serious opposition.
I mean the groups on the left?
That's right. I mean, he's the type of candidate that might bring together all the groups in the way that Bob Bork did to create a real comprehensive opposition to a Supreme Court nominee.
Well, let's find out why. Sam Alito's nickname is Scalito, because many say his judicial philosophy is in the conservative mold of Justice Scalia. In the coming weeks, we're going to go through his judicial record with a fine-tooth comb, I'm sure. But the one case that's been mentioned the most today is 1991's Casey versus Planned Parenthood, in which Alito was the only one who did not agree with the decision. The question was whether a woman had to inform her husband of an abortion procedure. What did Alito say to that?
Well, Judge Alito said that the law was presumptively constitutional, that the opposition to the law had not shown that that type of notice requirement was a serious restriction on the right to abortion. It was a view that was ultimately rejected by the Supreme Court. That's not the only time his view has been rejected. Quite recently, the Supreme Court reversed one of his decisions in the area of constitutional criminal law. He had written an opinion that said that a death row inmate had received adequate representation when six justices disagreed with that and said, no, that was not adequate, that this person on death row was entitled to new representation.
And just to further on the Casey case, the Planned Parenthood case, when Judge Alito wrote his dissent, in other words, he was for women having to tell their husbands prior to an abortion procedure, he said any problems they might have had, any considerations, would have been obviated by discussion prior to the abortion. So he felt that just talking with their husbands, they could have straightened any of their concerns out. Women's groups, of course, felt he was out of touch with women's concerns.
I think that's right, and that's the type of decision, and we're going to get more of those decisions that are going to haunt this nominee. Remember, this is an individual who is being praised because he has a record, and that record may prove to be as much of a curse as a benefit. We saw that with Bob Bork, copious record, and in that record, there were these negative sound bites. I think you're going to find that with Alito. He is very acerbic when it comes to some of his views, even though he's a very nice person, and he's someone who stands on principle. He is not afraid to be the lone dissenter and to take what some people might consider to be extreme positions.
Well, earlier we heard Ralph Nies of People for the American Way say that Samuel Alito believes that the Constitution has been misinterpreted since the 1930s, and he turned back the clock on a number of issues. Do you think that copious record will bear that out?
I think that Sam Alito's on the far right of the federal bench. I happen to share some of his libertarian views, but he is certainly breathtakingly conservative. And I think that some of the cases that are his most controversial are going to give him a hard time in that hearing room. He also has some personal issues. You know, he was involved in a conflict of interest involving a ruling he gave in a case in which Vanguard Corporation was involved. He owned over $300,000 in stock in that corporation, and many people felt that he should not have ruled in a case where he had personal financial interest, and eventually he did recuse himself. So it's things like that that are going to be combed out of this record.
Well, Lanier Swan of Concerned Women of America, on the other hand, praised Judge Alito as a strict interpreter of the Constitution. Others are going as far as calling him an originalist. Do we assume that if confirmed, he would form a voting bloc with Scalia and Thomas?
Yeah, I doubt there's going to be anyone to the right of Sam Alito. And he's also someone who is more likely probably than John Roberts to drop the hammer on precedent. I mean, I think that he will work to narrow aspects of Roe v. Wade, and I think eventually he probably would vote to overturn it if it came to that. What is clear is that we would be replacing a swing vote with a real hard right nominee.
Jonathan Turley, professor of law at George Washington University. Jonathan, thanks as always.
Oh, it's my great pleasure.
And just ahead, what are the political ramifications of the Alito nomination? We'll take a look. Also, later in the program, it is Halloween, and several states, including New Jersey, are telling registered sex offenders to stay home and not answer the door. The right thing to do to protect little kids, or a violation of civil rights? Much more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And we just heard law professor Jonathan Turley say President Bush picked a fight with his nomination of Samuel Alito for Supreme Court judge. Well, Democratic leaders are gearing up for that fight. Massachusetts Senator Edward Kennedy says the president chose Alito to shore up conservative support, not for the good of the country. And New York Senator Charles Schumer says the nominee is more likely to divide the country than to unify it. And the big question now is whether these words will lead to a Democratic filibuster on the Senate floor. Joining us on the line now with the political ramifications, John Fund, editor of the Wall Street Journal's OpinionJournal.com. John, welcome.
Pleasure.
And Joan Walsh, editor-in-chief of Salon.com. Welcome to you as well, Joan.
Thanks, Robin.
And John Fund, you told us last week how angry conservatives were, not just the Myers nomination, but the way it was presented to them. Does Senator Kennedy now have a point? Did President Bush make a nomination to appease that base? And in so doing, not take into account the needs of the whole country?
Well, I use the word disappointed rather than anger, and I will have to say I think Sam Alito has already drawn praise from surprising quarters. Today on CNN, a friend of mine, Lawrence Lundberg, who's a noted liberal civil rights activist, said, of course he's very conservative, but he is a man of great integrity, of great compassion, who reads the law fairly, and he supports his nomination.
Joan Walsh, was there any way that President Bush, with so many political problems right now, was there any way he could not nominate a strong conservative?
No, I think he had to do that, Robin. I mean, I think the backdrop today is a new USA Today poll showing that 55% of Americans consider his administration a failure. We saw over the weekend a Newsweek poll that showed that close to a majority of Americans felt that the Bush White House actually had lowered the moral tone after promising to change it after the Clinton administration. This comes on the heels of really, you know, shocking and saddening indictments of Louis Libby. I think the political climate is what created this appointment, and I think, you know, John and other conservatives and their criticism of Harriet Myers was part of it. And look, Harriet Myers was clearly the very weak choice of a very wounded president, but Alito is the choice of a wounded president who's just desperately trying to stop the bleeding on his right.
John Flynn, your thoughts on that? Because, you know, you wrote about, okay, disappointed, it was a better word, but disappointed Republican Party leaders who felt they were being strong-armed over the Myers nomination. Karl Rove was once known for keeping the various aspects of the party in line. Now, doesn't George Bush risk possibility of being seen as a weak leader just quickly responding to, some would even say, the fringe in the party?
Well, the 55 Republican senators represent more than a fringe. They represent the majority of the Senate, and they were elected by people. And I can tell you, with one or two possible exceptions, every single member of the Republican caucus in the Senate will be voting for Sam Alito. He is uniting the Republican Party and the conservative movement, not dividing it. And I will further stipulate that I know of at least five Democratic senators who will vote for Sam Alito.
Well, and Joan Walsh, you know, the question is, what happens then? What do you think is going to happen? John Flynn saying there is the support for Alito. Let's remind ourselves, Republicans had been threatening to call for a ban on filibusters, but there was a compromise called between moderate Republicans and Democrats.
Well, I think it's really too early to even talk about the filibuster, and I'm glad that John has the inside line on these Republicans and these Democrats who know what they're going to do before the hearings and before the record is really complete. But I think he's being very, very optimistic on behalf of his president. I don't really think that it's at all that clear. I think that we're going to learn more and more about Alito, and, you know, it may be that some Democrats vote for him. The question really is, will he attract the support of 55 Republicans, let alone any Democrats? And I think it's way too early to say that. I think that John's being very optimistic about the chances.
No, I'm being realistic because the Senate does two things. It both judges the qualifications of the nominee. It also makes political judgments. And if you look at Democratic senators and which of the nominees they have supported in the past that were very controversial, several Democratic senators voted for nominees like Priscilla Owen. Several Democratic senators voted for nominees like Bill Pryor of Alabama. Several Democratic senators, for political reasons, have had to support even lower-profile presidential appointees. You take a Ben Nelson of Nebraska or a Bill Nelson of Florida, and I can assure you they're both up for re-election next year, and they are going to have enormous political pressure applied to them because, barring a dramatic surprise, and I certainly will admit that that is conceivable,
it's quite conceivable.
The political pressures of Democratic senators in red states that voted for George W. Bush are going to be enormous.
Well, and John, just to follow up on that, because we are interested in your thoughts on this. John Roberts replaced a conservative jurist, the late Chief Justice Rehnquist, but aren't the stakes even higher because Alito would replace the moderate swing vote O'Connor?
Well, Sandra Day O'Connor, on most issues, with the exception of certain aspects of the abortion controversy, was a conservative justice. People refer to her as a swing issue largely because of abortion or affirmative action, which are two very hot-button issues but represent a very small number of the cases that come before the Supreme Court. Now, I understand a lot of people want to focus on those two issues, but a lot of Americans focus on other issues as well, or they believe that they want a judge who will fairly look at the law.
Well,
let me finish. Judge Alito was part of a majority that declared New Jersey Jersey's law banning late-term abortions as unconstitutional. He said it was unconstitutional, and he followed the law. He also has taken many decisions which conservatives would disagree with. It's not that he is a rigid conservative. That is, that he has a particular way of looking at the law, which is, does the law say what it should say in terms of the Constitution?
Well, and by the way, we're going to talk much more about his past decisions in the future, but he did vote that way because of existing law. But Joan Walsh of Slate, we're all talking about this today, and I'm wondering, one last question to you. Do you think that this is going to completely take the other big headline off the radar? On Friday, Vice President Dick Cheney's top aide, Scooter Libby, was indicted. Karl Rove escaped indictment then, but the investigation not closed. Minority Leader Harry Reid calling for Rove to step down. Is this potential battle in the court, or at least the hearings, going to take Scooter Libby out of the headline?
I think it does absolutely take him out of the headlines for at least a couple of days. I think that otherwise the big debate today would be, does Karl Rove have to resign? Did this investigation come so close to him that regardless of whether Patrick Fitzgerald felt that he could prove certain charges in a court of law, that Rove's behavior was unbecoming to somebody who's a chief of staff? And I think that that would have been what we would be debating today.
Well, Joan
not
Walsh,
how part of the right is Alito. But I don't think that
we'll take that up at another time. Joan Walsh, editor-chief of Salon.com. Also, John Fund, editor of the Wall Street Journal's Opinion Journal.com. I thank you both for speaking with us, and all those issues will be back on the plate when we meet next. Thank you. Much more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's here and now. The state of New Jersey will be clamping down on registered sex offenders during tonight's trick-or-treating. Under new rules, registered sex offenders must be off the streets by 7 p.m. They can't enter the door to trick-or-treaters, they can't go to parties where there might be children, and they can't take children, even their own, out for treats. New Jersey is the state where the 1994 murder of a young girl by a sex offender led to Megan's Law, which established the model for sex offender registries nationwide. Today's restrictions are new requirements. And joining us first on the line from Trenton, New Jersey, is attorney John Furlong, who has represented registered sex offenders in that state. John, can you start with your thoughts on New Jersey's restrictions for this Halloween?
Well, I think it's a complete waste of time, but it doesn't surprise me that the parole board, which is notorious for exercising power because it can, would issue a memo like this for no discernible reason that I can see. It's certainly not going to promote public safety. It's not going to lessen risk of any kind, and it is going to cost taxpayers a considerable sum of money.
Well, as you know, supporters say, of course it'll lessen risk, because you have a situation where children will be potentially right on the doorstep of a pedophile. Why isn't it a good idea to do a preemptive, take a preemptive measure?
Well, I'm not sure that the premise of your question is accurate, but let's start with this proposition. You're saying that children could be at someone's doorstep 364 days a year, but not after 7 p.m. on the 365th.
Well, it's because they don't normally go knocking on strangers' doors. I mean, Halloween, that's what you do on Halloween.
Well, actually, children come door-to-door selling things all the time. We had a very tragic murder case in Ocean County in New Jersey a couple of years ago, where a young man was trying to meet a quota for his local volunteer agency and ran across an older young man who took him to task and hanged him. But let me take it one step further. First of all, the curfew is after 7 p.m. In my experience, having taken my own children trick-or-treating, most of the trick-or-treating is now taking place before 7 p.m. Secondly, I took my kids trick-or-treating, and in my experience answering the door these days, most kids are accompanied by at least one parent in a group each and every time. This ban on having the fellows go to school parties where maybe their own kids are going to be participating, you're talking about one adult amongst perhaps 20 or 30 more with 20 or 30 kids in a classroom in broad daylight, and I just don't find there to be any thought process going into the likelihood of that scenario under any circumstances.
In fact, you've been quoted as saying that the best protection for children on Halloween is their parents.
One would think that the person most likely to be concerned about the welfare of a child is that child's parent. I realize that's not universally true, but for the most part, it is.
Well, as you well know, these new rules in New Jersey are part of a nationwide movement to restrict the lives of sex offenders. Texas, Illinois, Virginia already have Halloween restrictions for sex offenders. In Virginia, certain sex offenders have to report to the parole offices during trick-or-treating time, and they undergo treatment. And the woman who runs that program says that some offenders even show up even when they're not asked. It's almost as if they might feel safer there. What is the harm in having some extra, attention paid to a sex offender on this night, which, as others have said, is so tantalizing, potentially tantalizing for them.
The people who are covered by this rule or by this memo are not a monolithic cohort of pedophiles. They are perhaps one-third pedophiles, one-third sociopathic rapists, and one-third people who were caught up in the system because of inappropriate relationships which led to criminal charges. So what you're doing in the first instance is hitting a thumbtack with a sledgehammer. In the second instance, what you're doing is what I call the punch pillow effect. You're addressing an issue in one focused area and leaving unattended the other potential areas for abuse. If you really are serious about offering treatment for 4 hours on October 31st, why don't you offer them the free treatment 365 days a year?
Well, John Furlong, again, an attorney who's represented sex offenders, you obviously have some very strong feelings about this. What at heart do you think is going on here?
I think, first of all, that there is a culture of fear that is being cultivated by people like politicians, parole authorities, and law enforcement community. There has yet to be a candid and honest conversation in our society about what to do about compulsive sex offenders, which is not all sex offenders. They are amenable to treatment, and yet nobody wants to read that literature, even though it's freely available. And we can do it in a way that allows people to reclaim their lives, become productive members of our society, and, oh, by the way, it's far more likely to reduce the likelihood of future sex offenses. But the harm is to the sex offender himself, whose quality of life is being further diminished as his range of motion is being gradually and incrementally reduced to the point where he's going to be a prisoner in his own home.
John Furlong, also co-editor of the book Sex Offender Registration and Community Notification, a Megan's Law source book. Attorney Furlong, thanks very much for speaking with us.
It was my pleasure, and thank you for having me, Robin.
Well, Virginia is one of the half dozen states where sex offenders on parole are required to report to the Department of Corrections on Halloween under the Operation Trick No Treat initiative. The former offenders must show up at their parole offices between 4:30 and 8 on Halloween night. Joe Holland is director for the Eastern Region of the Virginia Department of Corrections. He joins us now on the line. And Joe, we've just heard some criticism of the program, and one of them is that there's no evidence that there's an increase in incidents during Halloween, so why have the program?
Well, our thought behind the process is that we could account for their whereabouts and know and be able to respond to any community criticism that may come about as a result to any allegations of any misbehaviors. So with the targeted offenders, we provide them instructions to report in between those hours. We bring them in a little bit before the trick-or-treat curfew, hold them there in. It's either in a probation and parole office, or sometimes we have used courtrooms, depending upon what the resources are in localities.
Do they get any kind of therapy work, or is it just a holding pen?
We do make an effort to engage the cases who are under supervision in meaningful activities when we bring them in. So we either have treatment providers or specially trained staff to provide either education or treatment groups during this. And we also use this as an opportunity to do our routine contacts that we're required to do with those who are under supervision.
Joe Holland, what do you say to the other criticism? And again, we just heard some from a defense lawyer, that this is a civil rights issue, that this is doubly punishing and restricting the rights of men who have done their time, that it's the parents' job to supervise their children on Halloween, and that it's society's job to rehabilitate and work with these men in the prison before they get to the homes.
Well, part of what we know about working with sex offenders is that there are triggers that gender that type of behavior that we're trying to work with them to effectively manage and change. People who are attracted, pedophiles or attracted to young children, you know, that's a trigger. And what we are trying in our efforts to do is to keep them from that situation, which is a high-risk situation for themselves and for children in the community.
Joe Holland again, director for the Eastern Region of the Virginia Department of Corrections. I said men would be in their homes. Of course, there can be women sex offenders as well. But how many are you dealing with in just your region, and how many would fit the profile of the predatory pedophile as opposed to another form of sex offender?
We're targeting between 300 to 400 offenders. that are being required to participate in this particular operation.
300 to 400 in just one region of the state of Virginia. Again, Joe Holland with the Eastern Region of the Virginia Department of Corrections. Joe, once again, thank you so much for speaking with us. You are listening to Here and Now. Well, there are two goals on Halloween, safety, of course, and fun. And this weekend, the buzz was that plenty of the latter could be had at the Boston Ballet Costume Shop Sale. Here and Now's Lynn Menegon was there.
$10.
I love this.
Have some fun right before Halloween. Get some fun stuff from the ballet. Own a piece of ballet history, you know? I'm Heather McLernan. I'm one of the wardrobe supervisors for the Boston Ballet.
Any really, really good deals here?
I love the bumblebees. I'm actually thinking about buying a bumblebee myself. They're just so cute. They're $5. You get pants, you get a little headpiece, and you get a set of wings. You wear a black turtleneck, and you're perfect for Halloween. It's great.
You're one of the takers of the fuzzy bumblebee pants.
Yes.
Why?
Well, we're having a Halloween contest at work, and I have nothing, and I have till Monday to figure out, and here it is, $5, so why not?
Why not show up as a bumblebee?
Exactly.
Now, why not show up as a ballerina in a tutu?
Been there, done that.
And tutu is shows too much leg.
Yeah, probably for the work environment, yeah.
This will be perfect.
I didn't get your name.
Diane.
You never know when you might need a sparkly leotard.
I'm Jeff Heyer.
Are you a ballet dad?
I am a ballet dad.
How many daughters do you have?
Two daughters who dance here all the time.
What are you looking for today?
Well, our daughters have seen most of these productions. They've admired most of the dancers who've done this, and this is an opportunity for them to feel more a part of it.
You ready? Yeah. Right.
So I just got this.
So $5 for the lovely bee costume. Big furry pants to keep you warm because it's snowing outside already.
Sunday. Go to Sunday outfit, don't you? You know?
Sunday brunch.
Sunday brunch.
A bee brunch.
Yeah. My name's Charles Haichu, and I run the costume department.
For how long?
This is my 8th season.
Almost everyone's
bought a bee, which is excellent.
Almost everyone's bought a bee? Why? Now, where are the bee costumes from?
They are from a production called Beehive, which was done, I believe, in the late 80s. And every once in a while we sell one off because people remember them, but it was time to sort of bring them all out and see what we could do.
Well, they're going.
They're going quickly.
Was this a good ballet?
I don't know. I never saw it.
It was all black and yellow?
Mostly black and yellow. There's a cactus that got pollinated on stage.
Is this cash only?
Cash only.
Okay.
Okay?
Yeah.
You can pay more money.
Okay.
Hello. Do you mind if I speak with you?
No, go ahead.
You are shopping for a cactus and bumblebee pants while wearing an orange fright wig.
Yeah, that's right.
You are a man who is not afraid to be bold.
Well, that's right. I have two girls, Audrey and Lulu, and they just love to dress up, so I'm all up for finding some nice costumes.
Wonderful. Is this for Halloween for you, too?
Well, actually, I found a bee costume for myself, but this dress-up stuff is for my girls.
Are you going to wear the wig at any point?
No. No, but I thought I can't pass it up for $2, and I will find a time eventually to use it.
And you're about 6 feet tall. With the wig on, you're quite commanding.
Yeah.
I didn't get your name.
Gert.
You've got one of the nicest tutus.
These have a lot of history in them. These were made at the Royal Ballet in 1965. All of these Sleeping Beauty tutus.
And these costumes for sale here today are?
They're actually just from either really old productions that we've remade costumes, like the Sleeping Beauty tutus and the Woodland Nymph skirts, and then productions that we won't ever do again. And I know that we won't do them, so I can actually sell off the pieces.
That would be the bumblebee.
The bumblebees, for instance. I don't think that we'll ever do it again. I might be surprised one day, but I'll deal with it then. Enjoy the bee.
Sounds of the Boston Ballet Costume Shop Sale this past weekend, produced by Lynn Menegon. And Lynn, thank you. She brought me back the Golden Vine and the Lilac Fairy Attendant tutus from Sleeping Beauty. Much as I'd like to wear them around the house, they'll be going to two very grateful little girls. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's here and now. The big story today is President Bush's nomination of U.S. Appeals Court Judge Samuel Alito for the Supreme Court. Judge Alito currently serves on the Philadelphia-based U.S. Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit. To sum up what we've discussed today, his pick is being praised by conservatives, criticized by liberals. Advocacy groups are already organizing the faithful for and against the nominee, and some Congress watchers are predicting this fight may end in a filibuster. Other stories we're following today, six American soldiers were killed in separate attacks in Iraq. These deaths made October the deadliest month in Iraq since January. Also, earlier today, the UN Security Council unanimously adopted a resolution demanding that Syria cooperate with the investigation into the death of Lebanon's former Prime Minister Rafik Hariri and warned of possible further action if Syria doesn't. One of the most enduring thrillers ever is the story of The Phantom of the Opera. Based on the 1911 Gaston Leroux novel, Phantom tells the tale of a lonely, disfigured spirit deep in the recesses of the Paris Opera House, hidden from cruel and prying eyes. But then he falls in love with the beautiful soprano Christine, and violence and destruction follow. You may be familiar with the Andrew Lloyd Webber version, but long before Broadway, Phantom of the Opera was a classic 1925 silent film starring Lon Chaney. That version has received new life in a beautifully restored print, scored by the Alloy Orchestra of Cambridge, Massachusetts. Recently, Here and Now's Bill Marks talked with Alloy Orchestra director Ken Winokur about Phantom and Alloy's other work with silent films.
The Alloy Orchestra has been in the forefront of sort of a new generation of musicians that are scoring music for silent films. I mean, most people, traditionalists, think that films should be done with, you know, scored with tinny solo piano sound. Now, you don't do that. How do you approach scoring silent films?
Well, we like to approach it with no preconceptions and no rules. We have our instrumentation, which is very unusual. Lots of percussion, lots of found objects, pieces of junk, horseshoes, bedpans, plumbing pipes, springs, whatever, a synthesized orchestra, a sampling keyboard. So it's not playing the sounds of Mars, but it's playing the sounds of an orchestra as recorded into a keyboard and played back. Then more traditional instruments, clarinet, accordion.
What is the attraction of silent films, which for a lot of people, they're not familiar with silent films, they don't see many silent films. What's the attraction for musicians?
Well, once you've seen some of these silent films, the attraction's very apparent. These things are absolutely fabulous. I mean, the film industry just geared up from the late 1890s to this peak of just unbelievable creativity within just a few decades. So the fun part is that as a musician in a silent film, there's a collaborative kind of aspect, even though they're all dead, which is really good because then they can't tell you what to do. So you get to add something, you know, of your own, something fresh, something modern, in our case, to, you know, an age-old piece of art.
Now, let me ask a little bit about Phantom of the Opera. What are the challenges of doing such a famous horror film, yet many people have the soundtrack of the Andrew Lloyd Webber musical floating somewhere in the back of their heads? I mean, you're not doing Andrew Lloyd Webber, I see.
We're not doing Andrew Lloyd Webber, and we are abominably ignorant of it. In fact, none of us had actually seen either the film or the play before we wrote our own. The challenge in this particular case for us, you know, we're known as a group that's brash, sometimes loud, exciting, you know, filled with energy. And this is not that kind of movie. This is a movie that's subtle and very tense and taut. And to do what we normally do would have completely destroyed this film. So our challenge was to tantalize the audience with this beautiful, creepy, melodic sense of doom. And that's where we tried to bring this film.
Well, I was going to ask about the party scene. How did you come up with the theme for that?
Well, what happens is, you know, the people are dancing around, and then the Phantom comes down the staircase in his red mask of death. And it's one of the most horrific costumes you can imagine. And so, you know, the effort was not to play up the party aspect of this, but to play up the tension and the, you know, the horror.
The you think the movie remains frightening today for contemporary audiences, or after graphic sort of visceral horror that we have today, will this look sort of old-fashioned?
You know, yes and no on that one. There are times in this film where you're going to pull out of your kind of reverie and say, oh, well, that was too silly. But for the most part, it remains a very, very powerful film.
A legendary scene in the 20s. Apparently people fainted, people screamed during the unmasking scene when Lon Chaney took off the mask and revealed what the Phantom's real scarred face was like. Now, talk to me a little bit about how do you handle a scene like that musically?
Well, this is one where I think you would say that we went off into a very modern style of music. It's very atonal. I think it would be easier to overplay the Phantom and destroy it that way than it is to underplay it. So we tried to actually be more subtle.
Let's listen to the music for that scene. Now, you have a particularly personal connection with this film, The Phantom of the Opera. You own it. You own the film itself, which is very unusual for a composer. I mean, you know, a musician to own the film. How did that happen?
My wife, filmmaker Jane Gillooly, and I had the opportunity to actually purchase the negative for Phantom of the Opera and have spent a great deal of time, effort, and money in the last year in supervising the restoration.
Now, The Phantom of the Opera, the print you have, is a stunner. I mean, not only does it have tinted scenes, which many silent films had, it also makes use of a very fascinating but somewhat archaic two-tone Technicolor process. So the party scene has some very interesting color combinations in it. And then there are some hand-painted scenes. So that flowing red robe of the Phantom was put in by hand. I mean, this is a spectacular print.
It's something I don't think most people actually recognize, that silent films were typically not black and white. They were almost always colored in some fashion.
Now, you've been touring with the film for a number of months now. How is it doing in terms of the response of the audience?
Oh, well, from the very first performance we did, we premiered it to the in Baltimore for the Maryland Film Festival. It's been phenomenal. There are a few films in the silent era that seem to transcend the others. And this is clearly one of that very select group of films that it so perfectly works with today's audiences. Audiences are really captivated by it. Anyway, it's been a huge success for us.
Ken Whitaker is the director of the Alley Orchestra. Thanks so much for coming.
And percussions.
And percussions.
Thank you, Bill. My pleasure.
Ken Whitaker spoke to Here and Now's Bill Marx. The other Alloy Orchestra members are Terry Donahue and Roger Miller. Alloy Orchestra will be performing Phantom of the Opera tonight in Philadelphia and New Hampshire on November 12th. For more information and other dates, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Have a safe and happy Halloween, and join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.